doom me, as though I'll give away something I can't take back. You aren't the first, you know, the voice continues. Gods above, how many of his brides I have visited over the cycle turnings. What? The question escapes my lips in a whisper, surely too faint to hear. But I clap a hand over my mouth, my eyes widening. Oh, yes. Damaris likes his mortal playthings. A pretty face. A lusty form. He has his fill of them, believe me. The voice ceases to pretend at pleasantry now, having acquired a knife-like edge. Three kisses he gives, and they try to resist, but never once has he failed to break down their defenses. When at last they beg him for their fourth kiss, then, one hears such tales, you know. I try to lick my dry lips, but my tongue has gone wooden and heavy. I take it you have not yet requested your fourth kiss, the voice continues relentlessly. A stalwart maid to the last. I've never known him to exercise such patience. That's right, little bride. Hold on to that maidenly virtue of yours while you can. For when you succumb, then you shall learn the truth of your bridegroom. The dark truth so few dare know. I stare at the door. In the center of the panel is a molding of flowers, but it seems to shift, morph, transform into a weird, warped, mask-like visage with narrow, cunning eyes and a cruel mouth. And the voice on the other side of the door flows through that image. He likes soft flesh, soft mortal flesh. His kind. They are neither giving nor gentle lovers. They are predators, taking what they will, savage and brutal. But the voice rises to a bright laugh that sends shudders coursing down my spine. But perhaps the gifts he has promised you make it all worthwhile. What is a little pain and a little shame in exchange for such bright, sparkling trinkets? I take one step back, then another. That laugh rings in my ears, brilliant and false and cold as diamonds of ice. My heart beats wildly, and when the knocking on the door resumes, I half fear it will burst open, that the ugly mask of molding will be replaced by a still more terrifying, living face. Go away, I say. My mouth silently shapes the words, but I cannot hear myself above the ringing of that laughter. Then I fling myself at the door, pound it hard with both fists, and scream as loud as I can, "Go away!" The laughter stops. So suddenly, so completely, it jars my senses. I reel as though I've been struck and sink to my knees, one shoulder pressed against the door. My eyes stare, and my mouth gapes open as I struggle to draw a full breath. Slowly, my whirling head clears. Did I imagine it? That voice? Those poisonous words? Was it a dream conjured by my own not-so-deeply suppressed fears? The anxieties I feel at the prospect of a wedding night with a bridegroom who may be a monster. I pull away from the door and look up. That molding in the center is a flower, a gracious lily with unfurled petals and feathery stamens, wrought in plaster and covered in brilliant gold leaf. Now that I look at it again, I'm not sure how I ever thought it was a face. Rising and rubbing my arms, I back away from the double doors. Even though the voice on the other side has vanished, even though the knocking has ceased, I don't like turning my back to it. I cross the expanse of the hall backwards until I finally can slip sideways into another room. Then I turn and run. 22. My feet slapping on the marbled floor, I flee through the gracious rooms with their pillared arches and silk-upholstered loungers. I take a turn, stop, and turn another way. How do I get back to the courtyard? I should stop. I should get my bearings. But the instinct for flight takes over, and I run again. I sense movement all around me. Flickers of shadows. The faint echo of voices. I turn my head sharply. Are those figures I see fleeing across the great room? Is that a woman cradling a small child to her breast? A man with his arms protectively around her? The image is brief, almost instantaneous. But in that instant, I could swear their heads are crowned with tall, spiraling horns. They're gone in a single flash of my eyelashes. A shadow flits across the floor and away. I turn, redouble my speed, and charge into another set of rooms. These are a little less spacious, a little less fine. Sunlight pours through tall windows, but a thick cloud passes overhead, casting the world into deep gloom. More shadows crowd the edges of my vision, just beyond the line of perception, yet terribly present. A snarl of racing legs, thrashing arms, and widespread beating wings. More screams echo in the silence inside my head. I press my hands over my ears, but still the echoes resound. Men, women, and children screaming, underscored by inhuman roars. And the hideous, gut-wrenching sound of weapons hacking into flesh. I stop, turning in place. My eyes swivel, trying to see what I cannot see. No matter how quickly I turn, I cannot catch a direct view. Nothing more than flashes. I'm screaming. I realize it and stuff my hands hard against my mouth, trying to stifle the sound. Ducking my head, I run again, taking the first turn I come to. The courtyard appears before me, and for a moment, my heart lifts with relief. The next moment, it jolts with fresh terror. Shadows fill the whole of that open space. Wild, manic shadows in attitudes of desperation and despair. Revulsion and heartbreak roll over me in waves. Gathering my skirts, I run through the shadows, trying to reach the corridor on the far side leading back to my rooms. Darkness swarms in around me, closer and closer. I feel the pressure of bodies, feel the stink of fear. My vision tunnels, and I scream again, the breath crushed from my lungs. Aralas! I wake with a gasp. I'm lying in my bed, staring up at the rafters of the ceiling. My heart thuds wildly in my breast, but I draw a long breath and let it out slowly, closing my eyes again for a moment. It was a dream. Just a dream. Vali, are you awake? I sit up, my weight sagging deep into the mattress of my loose rope frame bed. Where am I? Where? There's my little tallow candle in its clay stand, burned down to a waxy stub. There's my wooden comb where I left it on my side table. There's my work gown, my cap, my shoes, waiting for the day's service. Am I? Is this home? Vali, hurry, we'll be late. I open my mouth, try to speak. I'm coming, Brielle. The words form on my tongue but won't emerge no matter how I struggle. Frowning, I push back my covers and slide my legs out over the edge of the bed. Wait. Wait, what is this? What am I wearing? This isn't my simple muslin shift. My body is draped in robes of elaborate silk sewn with twinkling jewels. Bracelets of gold, dense with gems, encase my arms from wrist to elbow, and my neck is heavy with the weight of necklaces. I reach up to tug at them, to try to get them off, but they tighten at my touch. Vali! Vali, where are you? Vali, I need you! Please, Vali! I'm here. Brielle! I try again to cry out the words, but the necklaces have me in a stranglehold, choking away my breath, my life. I collapse back on my pillows, struggling to pull them free. Brielle, I'm here! My vision goes dark. But in the darkness, warmth. A scent like spices and a blooming night jasmine fills my nostrils. A sense of strength, of power encircling me, holding me, caring for me. I lean into that sense, my hand unconsciously reaching up to catch hold and cling. My striving, terrified soul relaxes, and the fear eases away. Aralos, I whisper. I'm here, Falera. I'm here. I open my eyes. A blue glow suffuses the room, gleaming off the white fur of my coverlet, glinting on the shining specks in the marbled stone of my bed. I turn my head slightly and see the dress mold in the corner, still draped in the lovely pink gown from Glorindal night. I turn my head the other way. An indistinct figure sits in the chair just beyond the edge of the moon firelight. His back is to me. I blink. My mind feels dull, foggy. What happened? My memories are confused, full of shadows. Did he find me lost in the labyrinthine halls and rooms of Oregon? Did I faint? Did he carry me here? I look down. Suddenly uneasy. I'm lying on top of the furs, still wearing my worn old work dress. No elaborate silks or twinkling jewels, no bracelets like manacles clutching my forearms. For a moment, I close my eyes and hear Brielle's voice desperately calling for me. It seemed so real and so close, just on the other side of my door. But it was only a dream. Drawing a deep breath, I sit up and look across the room. The shadow by the hearth has shifted, and I think perhaps he's looking back at me, though I can't say for sure. I bite my dry lips, trying to moisten them, then slide out of the bed. My bare feet land on the floor with a soft thud. My arms wrap around my middle, and I stand for a few breaths, uncertain what to do. Then I cross the space and take my seat in my usual chair across from my bridegroom. My lord, I say softly.
Milady,
he replies. It's the first time I've heard his voice since Glorindal. My heart gives a traitorous shiver. We sit a little while in silence. Finally, I pull myself up straighter and look across at him. I didn't let anyone through the door while you were gone. I don't know why it's important, but somehow I know it is.
I know, and I thank you.
Memories of those fleeing shadows play before my mind's eye. Are your people all right?
For the present.
You went away to help them?
Yes.
What happened to them? He doesn't answer. Of course not. The curse prevents him. Grimacing, I look down at my hands in my lap. Suddenly, all the speculations I've toyed with seem so foolish. Knowing a curse exists is one thing. Realizing how near and dangerous it is, that's entirely different. And I'm meant to break it? To save him and those terrified people I'd sort of glimpsed in a half-dreaming state of panic? It's too much. Too much to ask of me. I'm not brave. I'm not a barbarian queen, skilled with a sword, ready to throw myself into the thickest fray. I'm no heroine of legend, quick-witted and cunning. I'm a seamstress. No, less than a seamstress. A stitch girl. My fingers are calloused from any pricks of the needle, and I know how to drape fabric to flattering advantage. How can I possibly help? But Lord Damaris hasn't said he needs a warrior or a heroine. He needs a wife. Slowly, I lift my gaze and peer into the darkness across from me. trying to see what cannot be seen. I feel his eyes study me as I study him. I ought to say something. What, though? My mind is muddled, but my body is on fire. A certainty grows inside me, but beneath that certainty lurks fear. Hold on to that virtue of yours while you can, for when you succumb, then you'll learn the truth of your bridegroom, the dark truth so few dare know. Can I believe the strange woman's warnings or not? How can I know for sure? How can I put my trust in this man or even in my own feelings? He kidnapped me. All the rest, the kindness, the courtesy, the attempts to please and delight me, what do they matter in the face of such a terrible act? He claims he has reasons, claims he has needs. But can I believe any of it? It might all be part of his game, his ploy to get me willingly into his bed. For all I know, he really is the monster the stranger claimed. And yet, I stand suddenly. My knees tremble and my gut roils with a sensation I cannot name. A terrifying and utterly intoxicating sensation. Am I really going to do this? Do I have the courage? Aralos, I say quietly. I feel him looking at me, feel the intensity of his focused gaze.
Valera,
he responds. His voice is deep, rough, but I detect the faintest tremble. That invisible line of connection between us seems to spark until I can almost see it, bright as a burning filament. May I? I duck my head, my fingers curling into fists. Somehow I must summon the courage to speak, must find the way to force the words across my lips. May I touch you? He doesn't answer for such a long time, I fear I will fall into the silence and drown. The moonfire snaps on the hearth, its flames burning low. The shadows around us seem to deepen, darken, until I am all but blind. Finally, he says,
"Yes."
I move my feet, one after the other, approaching his chair. I can see no more than a dim outline of his form. He's tall even when seated, his head level with my shoulder. I think he sits with his hands gripping the arms of his chair, his face upturned to me. By that dim light, I can just discern the faint outline of horns. I reach for those first. Best to know at once. Best to acknowledge the reality of who and what my bridegroom is. Shivering, I stretch out my hand until my fingers brush a cool, coiled surface, then trail up a curve to a wickedly sharp point, sharp enough to make me flinch away. He holds perfectly still. Did I hear his breath hitch? It's difficult to tell through the throb of my own pulse in my ears. Setting my jaw, I extend my hand again. This time, I touch the top of his head and feel soft, thick hair. When I run my fingers through it, I find it very long, even longer than my hair, smooth as silk and faintly oiled and scented. Here, then, is the source of that delicious, spicy perfume I've unconsciously associated with him. I let my fingers trail down, running gently across a broad forehead, a stern brow bone. Is he frowning? Or is his brow naturally puckered like this? Impossible to say. I lift my other hand to join the first in exploration, touching the planes of his face, the sharp cheekbones, the smooth cheeks. I find his ears and feel how they taper to points. His breath catches, a short, shuddering gasp. I withdraw my hands. My touch has excited something in him. The invisible connection between us seems to tense, to twist, as though drawing me nearer. But I'm not ready for that yet. Neither am I ready to back down, however. Now that I'm here in this moment, I'm not eager to retreat. Without a word, I reach for his face again, feeling along the line of his jaw. Hard muscles flex under my fingertips, and my senses quicken with the increasingly rapid inhale and exhale of his breath. My hands move downward along his throat, feel him swallow beneath my touch. I come to his shoulders. Here I find fabric, light and loose, edged with some sort of gold braid. But it isn't fastened across the front, and I easily slip my fingers beneath to the smooth skin of his shoulders. Very wide shoulders, their muscles tight with tension. I rest my hands there for a few moments, standing before him, gazing into the shadow where his face must be, searching for some glint of eyes. But there is only impenetrable shadow. Blood humming in my veins, I move my hands along his shoulders, pushing back the fabric of his garment. My palms slide down a broad, muscled chest. For an instant, I can feel a heartbeat throbbing under my touch. A growl rumbles in the darkness. The next moment, he's standing, looming over me with barely an inch of space between us. I start and would leap back, but huge, long-fingered hands grip my wrists tightly. Seven gods, Valera. His voice rasps, his unseen face so close to mine that his breath tickles my ear. I'm not made of stone. I stand rigid, every sense, every nerve in my body sparking with fire. Heat rushes and roars through my veins, making my head light and my knees tremble. Ready to buckle and fall against him, fall into his eager, hungry embrace. Please. The word is soft, but edged with need so intense, it sends a shiver to my core. May I kiss you? My lips part. An answer hovers on the edge of my tongue, just waiting to be spoken. But those insidious words whisper in the back of my head. Then you shall learn the truth of your bridegroom, the dark truth so few dare know. I tug lightly at my right hand. He immediately lets go, and I reach for his face. His breath comes hard and fast against my fingertips as I rest them softly against his mouth. I feel full, sensual lips. Lips I have thrice felt against my skin, feather light and yet burning with promise. Lips I long to press my own against, to claim forever. Then I search with one finger and brush the edge of a sharp, pointed tooth. With a gasp, I retract my hand, my whole body jolting with a sudden rush of fear. My heart races, surging with desire and terror in equal measures. I can still hear his ragged breathing in the darkness, can feel his eyes watching me, ravenous with need, with hope. But I can't do it. I can't. I want to. Oh, gods, forgive me how I want to. My body aches with need akin to his, and my heart pulls at that connecting thread, longing to draw him close to me, to let our souls and bodies join. It would be so easy to give in. And then what? Will I let my mortal flesh be devoured by this beast, this unseen monster, my kidnapper and prison keeper? Will he tear into me with tooth and claw, sating his appetite on my maidenhood? And when he has what he wants, when the curse is broken or his desires fulfilled, will he leave me spent and broken on my father's doorstep, return to my own world but never fully able to return? A shade of my former self, forever changed by the darkness lurking beyond the edge of Whispering Wood. I don't want to believe it. I don't want to think such thoughts about him. Yet how can I afford not to? The only power I have here is the power to say no. I must hold on to that power while I can. I step back. For a moment, Only a moment. He maintains his grip on my left wrist, his fingers tightening. But at the least tug, he relents, and I retreat several paces away from him, back into the pool of moonfire light. Wrapping my arms around my middle, I lower my head and stare down at my bare feet. "Good night, my lord," I say, my voice soft but clear in that painful silence. At first, he does not answer. Though I don't look up, I feel the bulk of his body shift, hear the rustle of robes as though he's taking a step toward me. But he stops himself. The next moment, he withdraws deeper into the shadows, away from the firelight. I wait for him to speak his usual, "Good night, my lady." My whole soul cries out, longing for him to give me that small grace, an indication that I have not irrevocably damaged the tentative bridges we've been building between us. But he is silent as he turns to the door. I hear nothing, not even a breath, only the sound of his robes dragging behind him. Then he speaks a word, and the door opens. I drink in the sight of his silhouette, discernible by the faint light streaming through the stained glass windows in the passage beyond.
"I have a confession," he says.
I blink in surprise. It's not what I expected him to say. My chest tightens, my heart constricting painfully in my breast in fear of, I know not what. "A confession?" I echo softly. He turns. I see his two great horns clearly above the murky nothing of his face.
"It's about your sister."
The whole room pitches around me. I grab hold of the back of my chair. My mouth opens, desperate to speak, desperate to demand what he means. But my throat has closed too tight to let even a breath through.
"My servant returned to me after the events that took place in Orokin early today. Something has happened. He couldn't say what, only that the girl, Brielle, threw him off her track. She's gone deeper into Wanfriel, down paths he does not know. He could not follow her."
Brielle. My mind whirls in a storm bursting with such force, such pain, I cannot remain on my feet. My knees buckle. And though I try to sink into the chair, I miss, and instead fall heavily to the floor. Darkness closes in at the edges of my vision, blocking out the moonfire light. Suddenly, he's there, kneeling in front of me. His long fingers close around my shoulders, holding me upright.
"Valera."
His voice is husky, rough with worry.
"Valera, can you hear me?"
I shake my head. I don't know if I fainted or if I did, for how long, but my senses are returning now. I push his arms away, shuddering at his touch, and lift my face to where his should be.
"You promised me," I whisper.
I can't see or feel anything. I can only hear his ragged breathing.
"I promised to do everything within my power."
"You promised me you'd keep her safe."
"I swear, Valera, I would do anything to fulfill that promise. But she has grown crafty, and my servant has many times reported that she..."
"She is a child!"
This time, the words burst from my lips in a scream, harsh and grating. I want to hurt him. I want to lash out, to turn my own blunt nails into talons and rip his face open.
"She is a child, a mere child. How could she possibly... How could she..."
I can't even finish the thought. The violence erupting in me is so shocking, so horrifying. And deep inside my head, a tiny voice whispers, "Is this how father feels? Is this the depth to which heartbreak will drive a peaceful soul? Has this truly been inside me all along?" I bury my face in my hands, shaking my head as though I can shake those thoughts away. Then something hard and cold knots in my breast. I drop my hands and look up at him again, at the shadow, the nothing that is my bridegroom.
you would have kissed me, knowing what you know. How ugly my voice sounds in my ears. Good. I pour on the venom. You would have kissed me, taken me, undressed and unmade me, knowing all along that you've broken your promise. No, Valera. He sounds desperate. He sounds weak. I could never use you so. Can you not believe me? In that moment, I hate him. Then why did you not tell me? I snarl. Right away, before you should have told me.
I know.
There's a shifting in the shadows, a heavy sense in the air. He still kneels before me, and I think he's bowed his head.
Please, Valera. I would tell you all if I could, if the terms of... I would tell you everything. I would tell you how many lives depend on... I would tell you what's at stake. I would tell you what is in my heart, if only...
God's damn your heart!
The words burst from my lips, so much harsher even than I mean for them to be. Part of me, a larger part than I like to admit, regrets them at once, desperately wishes I could take them back. But I'm lost to my own rage, my own hurt, the agonizing spike of betrayal.
Get out! Get out of my room, Aralas! Get away from me!
He hesitates. I fear, I hope, that he will resist, that he will try to offer an explanation I can't help but believe. I don't know what I want more in that moment, to be given a reason to renew my trust in him, or simply to hate him. To hate him as part of me has always believed I should hate him. The wicked Fey Lord, the otherworldly creature, my kidnapper. He stands. He pulls the shadows around him, deeper than ever, an impenetrable cloak of night.
Good night, my lady,
he says. His voice is stricken, broken. Then he's gone, slipped through the door, which opens and shuts silently in his wake. And I'm left kneeling on the floor, unable to move, unable to think. Unable to do anything but breathe, draw air through my nostrils, hold it, let it out again slowly, waiting for my heartbeat to calm. Then, with a ragged, "Ugh," I sink my head into the seat of the chair. The warmth of moon firelight warms my back as I surrender to the flood of despair. 23. 3 days later, I wake in the pinking dimness just before dawn and stare at the domed ceiling overhead. Another day stretches before me, a day of solitude, save for Ellie's burbling chatter and the antics of the goblin men. I cannot look forward to the evening, for I already know Lord Damaris will not visit me. Nor should he. I don't want to see him. Never again. Or so I try to convince myself. Heat crawls up into my face and I press a hand to my cheek, my brow puckering. Conflicting thoughts and desires war inside my head. Has he gone away forever? Should I hope he has? Was I too harsh with him, unwilling to hear him as he tried to explain himself? But there's nothing to explain. He broke his promise. Brielle got through into the deeps of Whispering Wood, taking a path not even his servant could follow. A child, a mere child, and she managed to give his servant the slip. Unless that was a lie. But why would he lie about such a thing, knowing how I must react to the knowledge? Part of me tries to reason that Lord Damaris could simply have withheld the information from me. He could have let me continue believing that Brielle was safe and guarded. And in that belief, he may yet have broken down my guard and gotten what he wanted from me, his stubborn, difficult wife. Instead, He'd risked everything by telling me the truth. I shake my head viciously. Am I making excuses for him? Am I trying to justify his failure so that I can, what, justify my own longings? With an angry growl, I sit up in bed, grab one of the many soft pillows, and pound it for all I'm worth. It gives gently beneath my fists, an unsatisfactory victim of my rage. But at least it's something. After I've smashed it into an odd, lumpy shape, I sit quietly, breathing in and out. Maybe he's gone away forever. Maybe he's given up on wooing and winning me. What will that mean for the rest of my time here in Oricon? Must I face the rest of my year and a day term alone? If so, good. I'm glad he's given up. Glad he's accepted the truth that this marriage is no marriage at all. That no matter the requirements of his curse, no matter the images flashed before his eyes in the scrying pool, a wife cannot be captured and forced to comply to his will. Not that he's ever forced anything.
I'm not made of stone.
I close my eyes. Once more, I hear that impassioned voice rumbling in my memory. Something stirs in my gut, a faint reminder of the powerful sensations that had so nearly made me lose my head 3 nights ago. No. Tossing my abused pillow across the room, I push back my coverlet and swing my legs over the edge of the bed. For a moment, I sit there gripping the blankets and mattress with white-knuckled fingers. I won't let my mind venture down those dangerous paths. Won't let my imagination carry me back into that intoxicating darkness. Lord Damaris is gone. Possibly for good. Definitely for the better. And meanwhile, Brielle is... Brielle might be... I rise, dress, and move listlessly to my workstation, my chair and table near the fireplace. Over the last few days, I've been too distracted by nameless, formless fears from my sister to put much effort into my struggle with the cloth made of wind. Its edges waft gently around the weight anchoring it to the table. I can see the little seams of tiny, somewhat erratic stitches binding the various pieces of it together. My lip curls as I look at it, my disinterest in the project almost painful. But gods above, I can't bear to spend another day with my head in my hands, imagining how all the horrors of the Fey Wood might even now assault my little sister. No. Idle hands lead to idle thoughts, and I cannot bear to think anything right now. With a growl in my throat, I push the heavy weight aside and capture the windcloth before it flies away. Then I set to work with needle and thread, my fingers flashing in quick precision. After many false starts, I ultimately decided to make a simple garment of long, straight seams with buttons up the front. Large flaps of drifting wind drape beneath the arms, forming sails of a sort. It's odd, I know. Sails are meant to catch wind, not be wind. But it makes sense somehow in a non-rational but wholly inspirational part of my brain. So I follow the inspiration, and the resulting garment slowly takes shape in my hands. Ellie enters with a breakfast tray and warbles something at me while I work. It sounds scolding, but I don't try to discern what's bothering the green nymph. It has something to do with Lord Damaris, I'm sure, but my dealings with my husband, my captor, are none of her business. She bustles around to no purpose for a while before finally leaving. I don't touch the breakfast tray. I simply have no appetite. At last, after hours of stitching, adjusting, pinning, and more stitching, I pluck up my shears and snip a final thread. I hold up the garment to study the results of my labors. It's difficult to see. The wind itself is invisible. But whatever binding magic transformed it into fabric glints faintly blue and pink and silver, revealing the warp and weft of the woven threads. Otherwise, only a row of silver buttons, which I pillaged from one of the ornate gowns in my collection, and my own stitches are visible. It's an impossible garment, yet somehow it holds together. A small smile pulls at the corner of my mouth. I'm not happy, exactly, but I'm pleased. Pleased that the strange concept in my brain seems to have translated into reality. Pleased that I could make my mortal mind conceive and construct something so far beyond ordinary mortal comprehension. If I must spend this portion of my life in isolated captivity, this is certainly an interesting way to fill the time. Now, looking at the finished garment, I'm faced with a new set of questions. Will it work? And, of possibly greater importance, is it safe to try? You've got nothing better to do, I mutter, rising from my workspace. The garment tries to escape, fluttering in my hands like a captured bird. I bundle it up tightly and tuck it under one arm, then duck from my room and down the corridor, out to the courtyard. There I stand a moment, off to the side of the huge banquet table, looking up. The surrounding buildings loom three stories high, in places higher still, but open sky arches overhead. It beckons me, enticingly. Is it worth the risk? Maybe. But a girl can always take precautions. Bergabog? I call. Immediately, a long-nosed, bat-eared little figure wearing a pair of bright orange trousers around his neck like a scarf somersaults into view at my feet. The goblin pops upright, sweeps the bow, and places a gnarled hand against his protruding breastbone. Bergabogagog, he proclaims. Can you fetch me a length of rope? Something sturdy. The goblin tilts his head to one side, giving me a narrow look, his sharp eyes swiveling from my face to the wind vest under my arm. Then he shrugs and bounds away. While I wait, I walk the length of the table, studying both it and the pillars of the colonnades. By the time Bergabog returns with about 15 feet of strong cord woven from some fibers I don't recognize, I've chosen my spot. The end of the table, where the largest stone chair stands waiting for the presiding lord of the house to take his place. The chair must weigh at least four times as much as I do, and its elegantly arched arms provide a secure place to tie a rope. It will do. Bergabog must have gossiped as he went about his errand. I become aware of many goblin eyes peering out at me from among the colonnades as I secure the cord first to the chair and then to a loop at the back of the vest, laced there for this purpose. Their scrutiny makes me nervous, and I almost snap and tell them to scatter. Then again, what I'm about to do is undoubtedly risky and probably foolish, so it might be wisest to have witnesses in case something goes wrong. I shake out the vest and crane my neck to look up at the sky. It's only 15 feet of rope, and I shouldn't even get that high. But something about that great expanse unnerves me, and I almost fold up the wispy garment and call off the whole experiment. But what is the point of a vest made of wind if one doesn't actually intend to use it? Donning the vest, I take care to fasten the row of silver buttons up the front from navel to collarbone. Then I loop the wrist flaps in place, but fasten the belt strap tight around my waist, keeping the sails safely bunched under my arms. Any other cloth would be bulky if bundled and folded like that along my sides, but the wind cloth seems to simply disappear. Indeed, when I look down at myself, I can see the buttons and my stitches at the arm and front panel seams. Otherwise, I seem to be wearing nothing but my regular old work dress. Well, I've come this far. I might as well complete the experiment. I climb onto the seat of the chair, aware of all those watching goblin eyes. I sneak a glance around just quick enough to see the tips of long ears vanish behind pillars. With a wry grimace, I peer up at the sky. This is it. After a last tug to make certain my rope is properly secured, I reach for the belt. My hands freeze, not quite ready, not quite willing to do this dangerous, impossible thing. Come on, Valera, I whisper. What do you have to lose? Setting my jaw, firming my stance, I pull the belt free and raise my arms. The sail flaps unfold on either side of me in a rush of wind, swelling, gathering, tossing my hair wildly around my face. I feel the power of it grow, and my heart shivers. But I've come too far to back down now. I leap from the chair, and I land hard, jarring the bones in my ankles, then stagger to my knees. The wind around me drops to little more than a faint breeze, tickling at my skin. I close my eyes tight, growling in my throat, then stare down at my hands flattened on the stone pavement. Warring sensations of frustration and relief waft over me, neither quite able to outweigh the other. But I'm not finished. I get up and try to dust myself off, a reflex that proves almost comically futile in this instance. Then I study the courtyard, my eyes narrowing. I need a higher starting point. The tabletop is higher than the chair seat, but not by much. Still, if I jump and it doesn't work, I won't risk more than another bone jarring. But will playing it safe produce the results I want? My gaze travels a little higher, to the roof of the colonnade on my left, a good 10 feet high, at least. High enough. I felt the swelling wind around me, felt the power and force contained within my stitches, and I'm sure, almost sure, it has the power to lift me if I can just get it to activate somehow. A jump from that rooftop wouldn't kill me. I might break a leg or two, but it wouldn't kill me. Bergabok. The goblin appears on the table, standing between two tall candlesticks.
Gogagog.
He raises his arm in a smart salute. Can you and your fellows get me? I point to the colonnade roof. Up there? The goblin swivels his head almost all the way around on his scrawny little neck. Then he whips his face forward again, a huge grin mounding the wrinkles beneath his eyes.
Bergabogagog,
he says with conviction. The task involves a good 20 goblin men pushing and pulling, not to mention a certain amount of indignity. But soon enough, with a few squeaks and gasps along the way, I find myself scrambling up onto the top of the colonnade roof. It's only slightly slanted, but the tiles are rough under my hands and bare feet, and I must step with care to avoid the sharp edges. I turn and face out over the courtyard, and am immediately struck with a wave of vertigo. 7 gods. The prospect of broken limbs seems much worse now that I'm up here. Maybe I've miscalculated. This seems an awful lot higher than 10 feet, more like 20 or 24 or... Hastily, I turn my head skyward. You don't have to jump, I whisper. You're experimenting, that's all. You don't have to jump. I toss a quick glance over my shoulder at the goblin men who've lined up along the rooftop behind me, grinning expectantly. Would you gentlemen kindly hold the end of my rope? I ask. They leap to oblige. They feel strong, clutching the end of my tether. Their diminutive size is not an accurate indicator of their strength. Bergabog might be strong enough on his own to serve as my anchor. I gaze out over the courtyard again. My stomach turns over, and I quickly close my eyes. Then I tilt my chin upward and slowly peel open my eyelids. A blue expanse dotted with drifting clouds beckons. Now that I've come this far, how can I possibly back down? I open my eyes. The sail fabric spreads on either side of me, the wind gathering, swelling, growing. I close my eyes again and feel the power of it around me, neither fully tamed nor fully wild. I've never been sensitive to magic, but not even I can deny the enchantment flowing through the weave that binds strands of wind into cloth. And my own stitches hold it all in the shape I have determined. I feel the pull of open air. One, I whisper. The word slips out and is lost in the rush of wind. Two, my hair tosses and snarls around my face, but I shake it back, open my eyes, and stare up into the sky. Three, I leap. There's a moment, a pure, perfect, beautiful moment. A moment of weightlessness, of perfect suspension upon a mere thread of hope. Followed by a moment of crushing, terrible weight dragging me down. 24. My hope switches from soaring to shattered in the eternity of a single half instant. I'm falling, tumbling, bound to break into a thousand pieces. But then, with a gusting roar and a tumult of energy that steals the breath from my lungs, my body surges skyward, as though I've suddenly lost all mass and become light as a drifting dream. I tumble higher, utterly out of control, until the snap of the cord at my back jolts the breath out of me. I twist, looking back down to the goblin man all piled on the end of the cord, holding fast. And I see how far up I've toppled. Seven gods, I cry, my arms jerking. The sails flap on either side of my body, and the force of wind around me shifts, lessens. I'm sinking again and sinking fast. Instinct alone makes me spread my arms wide as though to catch myself. The wind increases. The feeling of weightlessness returns. I manage to achieve a sort of balance. Upright, legs kicking, arms stiff but stable at my sides. My heart pounds so fast, I fear it will burst. But I'm doing it. I'm flying. A cheer rises from below, only just audible over the rush of wind. I look down and see the goblin men whooping, their ugly faces split with triumphant smiles. I breathe a nervous laugh and offer a little wave. My body tilts unnervingly at even this slight movement, but the goblins redouble their cheers. They raise their fists in the air, spin and holler, grab each other, and grin up at me. While one by one, they drop the rope. Wait, no, I cry. I think I see Bergabog, foremost of the crew, look up. His orange scarf trousers waft in the wind, and his eyes widen. He lunges for the rope as it rises. Too late. He makes a tremendous leap, but his gnarled fingers bat uselessly at the end of the rope as it floats beyond his grasp. I scream. But the wind steals my voice as I'm carried higher, arms and legs flailing, hair and skirt snapping about like flags in a hurricane. The windows of the buildings around me flash before my tumultuous vision, passing much too quickly. The open sky looms hungrily above, waiting to devour me. Just before I'm lost to crazed terror, a jolt of desperate reason passes through my brain. I have just enough wherewithal to pull my arms closer to my body. At once, I feel the effect. The wind reduces. I'm still rising, but not quite so rapidly. I pull my arms closer and begin to fall. But when I open them again, just slightly, I level out. Heart pounding, head spinning, gut churning, I shake hair out of my face and dare to look around. I immediately wish I hadn't. My stomach plunges, and for a moment I fear my sanity will break from sheer fright. I have floated as high as the tallest of Orokin's many towers, bobbing gently in the air, I would guess nearly 200 feet above the courtyard. I can see the many levels of rooftops, walkways, walls, and yards spread out below me like a doll's landscape. Seven gods preserve me, I breathe. Though, by this time, they've got to be wondering what's the point of trying. Carefully, Every limb trembling violently, I angle my arms and shoulders, adjusting my midair stance. It's not altogether unlike being in the water. I'm not much of a swimmer, but both Brielle and I like to slip away to the lake from time to time, where a hidden bend behind a veil of willow trees offered a little privacy if a girl wanted to shed a few layers and take a cool plunge on a hot summer day. I know how to keep my body afloat for short periods of time. This is similar. Also, easier. I need my muscles to balance and angle myself, but the wind garment does all the hard work of buoyancy. And now that I'm past the initial terror of thinking I'm about to fly all the way to the highest heavens, where the sheer glory of the gods will blast me to oblivion, I draw several deep breaths, pushing such thoughts away. I'm all right. I can handle this. Moving my arms gently, I turn my body slowly around. My gaze scans Orokin, both the familiar parts I've walked many times and various courtyards and walkways I've not yet bothered to explore. From this height, I can also see the landscape beyond the palace, not the many different folds of reality glimpsed through windows and from over balcony rails. No, this is the land in which this part of Orokin really stands. Forest, as far as the eye can see. Orokin and its walled gardens provide the only break in the density of green treetops spreading like a vast ocean in every direction. My chest tightens, my heart seeming to pull deeper inside of me as I take in this reality. I knew already, of course, or I suspected. My one glimpse through the front doors all but convinced me that the fold of reality in which I currently reside is nestled deep in Whispering Wood. Now I know for sure. I also know that if I ever work up the nerve to step through those doors, I'll never find my way home. My heart feels like lead in my breast, so heavy that the wind vest sags. I sink slightly in the air, but quickly spread my arms, palms down, and catch a precarious balance. Hearing a shout below, I look down between my feet to see the green figure of Ellie far below, making large gestures. She seems to be kicking goblin men and beckoning me by turns. Her voice sounds faint to me up here, but I can hear the frantic worry clearly enough. I cut my hands around my mouth. "Coming, Ellie!" I shouldn't frighten her, at least no more than I already have. She puts up with so much from me as it is. Turning in the air, I try to angle my body downward while simultaneously drawing my arms closer to my body, reducing the amount of wind. It's too much too fast, and I plunge with a sickening lurch. Reflex makes me open my arms wide again, and back upward I surge. I catch my balance and struggle to catch my breath as well. This is going to be much trickier than I anticipated. I roll my shoulders carefully and prepare to try again, but just then, distant movement catches my eye. It should be too far away to notice, yet somehow it draws my gaze. I lift my chin to peer out beyond the rooftops of Orokin into the forest. In a small break in the trees, very small, hardly enough to notice, a figure stands, tiny, distant, much too far away to see with any clarity. And yet, somehow, I know her at once. Brielle! 25. I stand in the great entrance hall beneath the huge domed ceiling. Before me looms the double doors, which I have opened only once before. Behind me, Ellie and the goblin men, having followed me in from the courtyard, watch me closely. The green nymph burbles a string of worried scolding, and the goblin men mutter and grumble among themselves. I ignore them. I grip my skirts with both hands, staring at the door. Getting safely down onto solid ground again had required several attempts, but the sudden urgency surging through my veins drove me almost to the point of carelessness. My body is bruised all over from a rough landing. I don't care. My wind vest is crammed back inside the golden locket now hanging around my neck. That glorious, terrifying flight already feels like a distant memory. My heart pounds in my throat. Brielle. Brielle is out there. Or did I imagine seeing her? Did my brain, dizzy with both the success of my creation and the shock of flying to that great height, conjure the image of my sister? Brielle, clear as day, standing out there in that open space, staring up at me with her hand shading her eyes. No, it couldn't have been real. Only in a dream could I have seen across such a distance with such clarity. Perhaps rising above the protective walls of Orokin exposed me to the magic of the Whispering Wood. Maybe it was all some dangerous enchantment. Or possibly, my sister is truly out there, just on the other side of that door. I take a step. My gaze drops to the sculpted flower in the center panel of one door, searching for some sign of the hideous face I'd thought I glimpsed the day when the stranger pounded at the door, demanding entrance. But it's just an ornately gilded flower made of plaster. That sense of dread, the undeniable presence I'd felt through the door that day, is absent. All is still. Very still. Ellie's voice trills behind me. I pause, hand on the latch, and look back. The nymph stands on the other side of the hall, hands clasped against her bare bosom. Several dozen goblins surround her feet, all watching me with enormous, moon-wide eyes. Ellie shakes her head slightly, her antennae moving and twitching over her head. But they won't stop me. Perhaps they can't. I am Lord Damaris's wife, the Lady of Orokin. I am free to come and go as I will. Free to make a fatal mistake if I so desire. I try to swallow, but my throat is too dry. I face the door again, straining my ears for some sound on the far side. Maybe I can open it a mere crack and peek out, just a glimpse. Surely nothing could get through if I'm quick. And I have to know. Drawing a deep breath, I turn the latch. The door is heavy, but it swings easily on its hinges, pushing outward. I keep hold of the latch and, holding my breath, peer out. Valley! My heart stops. Someone stands on the threshold, just 3 steps down. A young woman clad in green, with tall brown boots up to her knees. Her hair is tied back in a knot, but strands escape and frame her face in brilliant red. Wide hazel eyes gaze out from beneath stern, straight brows, and freckles dust her nose. No. The word